as long as you understand the conditions. If it was 50 ohms of impedance on the input and 50 ohms of impedance on the output, your amplifier is amplifying the signal, but it's not simultaneously doing a impedance conversion. In that case, 10 dB of gain in power and 10 dB of gain when you calculate it in volt.
Repeater, time out.
When you calculate in voltage will be the exact same number of decibels. So yes, and there will be a difference if, for instance, my amplifier had a 50 ohm input impedance and a 100 ohm output impedance. Now the apparent voltage ratio in decibels and the apparent power ratio in decibels will, to a naive person, be a different number of decibels. Just know that there is a confusion factor there if the input and output impedance is not the same. But under most normal conditions, since that receiver you're using right now, Paul, has approximately 120 decibels of gain, if you measured the number of microvolts going into the antenna connector, and you measured the number of volts going into the loudspeaker, and assuming naively your loudspeaker was a 50-ohm load, and I could buy a set of earphones that are a 50-ohm load. If I measure the voltage coming out of the earphone connector in volts, and I measure the microvolts going in, they would be 120 decibels apart. One microvolt going to one volt, you calculate 20 log of that ratio, it will be 120 decibels. A good radio receiver will get you an acceptable signal going into your FM receiver of one microvolt. It'll give you 20 dB of quieting, and you'll be pretty happy. Coming out of a 50-ohm loudspeaker would be 1 volt of signal. 1 volt versus a microvolt, a million to one ratio. I take the log of that, the answer is 6. I multiply by 20, I end up with 120. That's one way of looking at a voltage calculation ratio for the receiver you're using right now with 120 dB of gain. If I measured the power coming out of your loudspeaker versus the power going in, I'd have to take the 1 microvolt going in, and it's 50 ohms, E squared over R, in order to calculate it into watts, which is micro-microwatts, if you know what I mean, and out comes roughly a watt of audio. I again would come up with 120 dB of gain if I did the correct calculation in power. 120 dB, whether it be voltage or power, when the impedance is the same, is the exact same gain in decibels. I think you've got it, Paul.
Repeater, time out.
And as you use these factors more and more, it'll become a little more familiar with you. Let me turn it back to you, Paul, to make sure that it all makes some sense. And as you were talking, you suddenly realized decibels is where the 10 to 1 ratio is coming from. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, because as you were talking, I wrote down 120 dB. And then next to it, I wrote 12 zeros. And I had an equal sign and a cross through it because it didn't equal it, you know. And that's what happened there, Dick. Very good. I wonder, is there some kind of a highfalutin voltage meter that could read microvolts? You know, that would be really cool to read the microvolts coming off of an antenna and actually, you know, could make that comparison, you know, directly to something like that. They make some kind of a $10 million piece of equipment that does that?
I own a whole lot of them. So do you, Paul. That receiver you've got right now has a signal strength meter on it. You can, if you want to, borrow somebody's real good, well-calibrated signal generator. You could put various numbers of microvolts into the antenna connector of that receiver and write down how many microvolts in, or how many negative dBm in. By the way, 1 microvolt is minus 107 dBm. Minus 107 decibels with reference to 1 milliwatt, that's what dBm means. Minus 107 dBm is 1 microvolt on a 50-ohm system. You can measure how much the S meter reads. Your S meter might read S1 with a microvolt. It might, with 4 microvolts, read S2 and so on. Your receiver has an S meter, which is not calibrated yet, but you could force it to be calibrated if you wanted to. And I've done that. I did that way back in the late 60s, and everybody I talk to on 432 would say, hey, Dick, you're the guy that's always telling me how many microvolts of signal I'm giving you. You said that my signal was 30 microvolts yesterday. I've just made this change to my antenna. I raised it another 10 feet. How many microvolts you're reading today? And I go back to the card file of mine. I'd look up his call letters and say, yeah, used to be 30 microvolts yesterday, and today it's 40 microvolts. You made that many decibels of improvement in your antenna when you raised it at extra altitude. So every one of your receivers can be calibrated in microvolts or dBm if you desire. Every spectrum analyzer happens to read across the cathode ray tube dB and 10 dB per centimeter steps, but most of them have a built-in calibrator, and by way of the calibrator, you could write on your grease pencil or on your graph paper, if you like, everything that's on that screen could be converted to microvolts. It is measuring exact power. Every spectrum analyzer, every vector network analyzer, every microvolt power meter. There's a whole lot of companies that made microvolt meters. It really is something equivalent to a ham receiver with a signal strength meter. You've had a lot more of those measuring instruments in your hands. You just didn't recognize it. Back to you for a quick one on that one, Paul. You got more instrumentation in your house there in Ronkonkoma than you...
Repeater, timeout.
You got more traceable laboratory equipment in your house in Ronkonkoma than you knew about, Paul. WS2N, KQLIW.
Okay, fine business, Dick. I said you were going to tell me some million-dollar piece of equipment in AIL. I didn't realize you were going to tell me that. All I would have to do is calibrate it. Every week we have a Connecticut simplex net. That would be fun to do. Calibrate everybody's receiver instead of giving S-meter readings, you know, back and forth on a simplex net. That would be good to go. That would be great. Very good, Dick. I'll stand by. Thanks for the info. Just got to make one comment. I'll probably never make 10 cents of doing all of this, but it sure is interesting. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, you've got a little piece of knowledge, and you can decide to use it, to increase your salary, to increase your pleasure of the ham radio hobby. The choice is yours. And I became a very popular guy on 432 because I was telling everybody how many microvolts they were giving me today. And we were comparing signal strength readings on summer, winter, spring, fall, rainy days, sunny days, and whatever. And we saw all of those correlations. We knew exactly how much foliage attenuation you were getting if your 432 antenna was too low compared to the local trees, or if it was high enough to clear the local trees. The guy whose antenna cleared the trees, he measured the same signal strength to me almost all the time. The guy whose antenna was below the trees in the summertime when the rain was on those leaves, his signal was 15 or 20 dB weaker. Because of foliage attenuation. I was giving him those answers in microvolts or decibels, whichever he wanted. And that made me a very popular guy. So I was doing it to become popular, if you know what I mean. I was doing it because I was interested. Mr. JXN, is it KC2, KA2? Are you Pat or Chris? Mr. JXN, you've got it. K2RAW, my name is Dick. Mr. JXN, I'm sorry to say we didn't copy any of that. I didn't realize you were mobile, and I guess you were moving out of the area. If you do come back in the area where we can hear you, come back with your question, or if you come back next week, we'll put you high on the list and not keep you waiting so long. Sorry about that. KC2, Alpha Zulu. I guess that's you, Paul. K2RIW, go ahead.
N2SCL in the group.
I think that was me. AC2AZ, Alpha Charlie 2, Alpha Zulu, Dick.
And your name is?
It's Bob again.
Okay, Mr. Bob again. Go right ahead.
I wanted to put my 2 cents in about the return loss bridges. Real quick, often return loss bridges are considered to be purely RF. They separate forward from reflected, very much the same way your regular SWR meter does, except the SWR meter also has a return loss bridge. They have the rectification to drive a meter. I'll make another generalization off from return loss bridges are for, you know, 10 dBm and below. They're generally associated with low-level measurements, very, very low-level measurements. You know, what would be typical with a 10 dBm generator and your spectrum analyzer. SWR bridges, on the other hand, need a little bit more power to forward bias those diodes and provide rectification for the meters. So they are very, very similar. They just work in different domains. That's really the major difference. They do tend to be more broadband because they don't use the transformers or the diodes of rectification that the regular SWR meter uses.
WHSCDL.
Andy, recognize CDL. Okay, if I don't write it down, I'm gonna forget you. Pat, very good. Bob, very good piece of information you just gave us that I should have made clearer. Something like a bird watt meter measures directional characteristics, how much power is going forward, how much power is coming back. The bird watt meter tends to run at 1 to 1,000 watts. It's a high-powered device. A return loss bridge makes the exact same measurement, forward power versus reverse power, but it does it at the milliwatt level. A noise bridge does it at the microwatt level. So noise bridge, very low signal levels, will measure you forward versus reverse power on your antenna system. A return loss bridge does it in the milliwatt level. A bird watt meter does it at the watt level, many watt level. A directional coupler, depending on what you're using as the detecting device, could be all of the above. I have used a directional coupler into a spectrum analyzer where I was measuring 1,000 watts of power flowing forward and looking at the ratio of what came back. If I set the spectrum analyzer sensitive enough, and if I was using a directional coupler with a low enough number of decibels of coupling coefficient, I could have made the measurement at the microwatt level or the milliwatt level. All of these instruments that measure standing wave ratio like characteristic, by one means or another, are telling you what ratio of power is going forward, what ratio of power is coming back. That's the real information. You can interpret it as that ratio, express it as decibels, and it's called decibels of reflection coefficient. You can measure it in watts forward or reverse watts if you want. You can take those numbers into the right formula and convert it into standing wave ratio if you want to be traditional. But that's just re-establishing tradition, which we don't do that anymore because it was originally measured with a Letcher wire system or a slotted line. But we don't use those anymore. They're too big and bulky by comparison. Okay, Mr. SCL first was before Andy. Mr. SCL, N2SCL, I think it was. What was your question or comment, sir? Start off with your name. My name is Dick.
Yeah, hi, Dick. It's Gary. November 2, Sierra Charlie Lima. Yeah, listen, I had a question. This goes way back, though, from earlier. If you have at the feed point of an antenna, you know, at the end of the cable, you know, the signal goes out, and right at the feed point of the antenna, you have a bad antenna. Let's say you have such a bad antenna that at that feed point, gamma is equal to 1, so you're like somewhere on the outside of the Smith chart. How do you determine where you are on the outside of the Smith chart? Like what governs whether it's going to look like it's short in the Smith chart or an open or up at the top or at the bottom? How does that work?
You can't be outside of the Smith chart, Gary. If your system is properly calibrated, it can't be outside of the Smith chart because the Smith chart includes every possible impedance from 0 to infinity in resistance, from minus infinity to plus infinity of reactance. Every possible impedance of a passive network, and your antenna plus transmission line should be a passive network, every passive network has to fall on the Smith chart. Now, what happens in a lot of guys is they set up a Smith chart display on a vector network analyzer. That's a fancy machine that displays your real impedance of your system on a Smith chart on that cathode ray tube, so to speak, or on that display device. That's what a vector network analyzer does. And if you tell the vector network analyzer, I'm using a piece of cable with 1 dB of loss, and it readjusts everything accordingly so that you're now referencing what displays on the screen as at the far end of that cable, and then you don't put in that cable. You've told the analyzer there's a dB of loss, he's readjusted the gain accordingly. But then you take that piece of cable out and you do a calibration procedure on the analyzer and you'll end up on the outside of the chart. Well, you've lied to the machine. You've told it there's a dB of loss there, and in the measurement you're now making, there ain't a dB of loss, and therefore he'll end up on the outside of that Smith chart screen. Whenever you see a display outside the chart, 99% of the time, you've made a pilot error, in my opinion, Gary. N2SCL, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, no, what I mean is, I know you can't, assuming that you're looking right at the feed point of the antenna, earlier you said that it was a short circuit. Now, when you have a short circuit or an open circuit, you're going to be either on the right side at a specific frequency. Let's just keep it to one frequency. If you're using one frequency and you have a short circuit, you're going to be on one side of the R line, and if you have an open circuit, you're going to be on the other. Now, if you have a shorter open circuit. Now, when you have an antenna that's such a bad match, like you said, it looks like a short circuit. How do you know it's a short circuit? Like, what is it about the physical structure that makes it a short circuit? Or was it just a specific antenna you were talking about earlier? Or could you explain that? This is where I'm confused. Go ahead.
Okay. The best way to use a transmission line where you make measurements of the insertion loss in the shack, and you don't want to go up to the top of the tower, so to speak, with your instrumentation. You don't want to bring the instrumentation to the top of the tower, but you want to make the measurement in the shack, and you want to find out what is the loss of the cable. You could, if you want to, have your assistant climb the tower, open up the antenna connector, and put in a short circuit plug at the end of that cable. And then in the shack, you make a standing wave ratio measurement, a voltage reflection coefficient measurement, call it whatever you like, but you're making a ratio measurement in the shack of that transmission line. All the power you're sending into that transmission line goes up to the top of the tower, hits the short circuit plug, and reflects back. And if what you reflect back into the shack has got 2 dB of loss, and you know the power has been up and back, you could say, okay, my transmission line's got 1 dB of loss. If you now remove the short circuit plug, and you're working at a low enough frequency where the connector on the end of the cable does not radiate. At 10 gigs, it would radiate, but at, let's say, for instance, 14 megacycles, that cable ain't going to radiate. You put an open circuit instead, and you go back in the shack and you make that measurement, you'll measure the exact same 2 dB of loss round trip, indicating 1 dB of loss. In other words, the power going down the cable, whether it sees a short circuit and reflects back, or sees an open circuit and reflects back, you've changed the phase angle of what comes back, but the power ratio would come back is the same. A short circuit will not absorb any power, an open circuit will not absorb any power. Now, if you're a real scientist, you can put a perfect capacitor on the end of the cable, or a perfect inductor on the end of the cable. The capacitor will not continuously absorb power. The inductor will not continuously absorb power. So when you make a scalar measurement in the shack, you're just measuring amplitude of reflected signal. In all cases, you'll see 2 dB of loss. Just that now, if you had a vector network analyzer in the shack, when you put a, and if you properly calibrate the whole system, you put a short circuit at the end of the cable on your Smith chart display. Let me drop. You'll see a dot on the far right-hand side, far left-hand side, representing 0 ohms. Put an open circuit on the end of the cable that's properly calibrated into your vector network analyzer. The Smith chart display will show you a dot on the right-hand side, infinity in ohms. Put a great big inductor on the end of the cable, and the Smith chart will show you a dot near the top of the screen representing a large number of ohms of inductor reactance. Put a capacitor on the end of the cable, and your network analyzer will display on its Smith chart screen a dot near the bottom of the screen, representing a large amount of capacitor reactance. Now, if you do it the other way around, you've calibrated the network analyzer with your particular piece of cable. In other words, the piece of cable was rolled up in the shack, and you calibrated the analyzer with the cable. You did the short, the open, the load, and whatever, and you calibrated with that length of cable. And the analyzer knows that length of cable is there. And now you put a short circuit on the end of that cable, and you sweep the frequency. The dot that started off on the left-hand side, representing 0 ohms, will now sweep, and it'll be a line that goes around the perimeter of the chart. It'll go clockwise as you go up in frequency. What's happening is that the signal going down the cable, which is some number of wavelengths of cable, hits the short circuit and reflects back. As you go to higher and higher frequencies, which is a smaller and smaller number of wavelengths, the same number of feet of cable represents more wavelengths at that newer, higher frequency. Therefore, the Smith chart dot will stay on the perimeter of the screen, but it will rotate around the screen clockwise. The screen is telling you what is the phase angle of what came back. As you go up in frequency, the phase of what came back is more delayed because there's more wavelengths in the cable at a higher frequency. I know that's a lot of information. The first time you hear it, Gary, it's going to be confusing. I understand that. When you hear it a few more times, it'll start making a little bit more sense. N2SCL, K2RIW.
Yeah, I'm not making myself clear. I understand. My question was not about making a practical measurement. My question was like purely theoretical about looking into the feed point of the antenna. You were basically saying earlier that I missed some of this because I was driving, so I had to stop where the signal was good. But earlier on, you guys were talking about a bad antenna match because you were talking about the loss of the cable. You know, you have a certain signal going down the cable, you have a certain amount of loss. The signal reaching the antenna is lower based on the insertion loss, and there's a reflection, and the signal coming back is you have the loss again on the return trip. So, like, I understand all that. The problem is what I was just addressing is that you kept saying that the antenna was a short circuit, that the guy had a short-circuited antenna. But my question is, how do you know it was a short circuit? Like, why couldn't it have been an open circuit? Or why couldn't it have been at the top of the chart or at the bottom of the chart? That's what I was asking.
Good question, Gary. Had I worded what I was saying more correctly, I would have said your antenna is acting as if it was a short circuit. Now, when it comes to a Smith chart display of your particular antenna, and if your antenna was as bad or worse than the antenna Joe was talking about earlier, there's an infinite number of ways the antenna can be as bad as a short circuit. It can truly be a short circuit. That'll accept no power, and you get complete reflection. It can truly be an open circuit. It'll accept no power, and it'll all be reflected. It can be a pure inductor with no resistance to it. All the power will be reflected. It can be a pure capacitor, and all the power will be reflected. So every one of the dots that you can place on that Smith chart, that's on the perimeter of the Smith chart, represents complete power reflected, as bad as a short circuit. When you retune the antenna so that the dot representing the impedance of that antenna falls on the center of the chart, which is 50 ohms resistance and no reactance, now you know that all the power going up that 50 ohm transmission line is going to be accepted by the antenna, and hopefully all of it will be radiated into space. When that Smith chart is showing you a dot on the screen, it really is a polar display. The radius of the polar display is the voltage coefficient. Out at the perimeter, you're drawing a stroke from the center of the screen out to the perimeter and putting a dot there, and that represents unity in voltage reflection coefficient. If your antenna is a perfect 50 ohm load, nothing reflects back. The network analyzer has nothing to display. It'll give you a dot in the center of the screen. So how far you are from the center of the screen is telling you exactly what percentage of power was accepted by the antenna and what percentage is reflected back. The perimeter is bad, the center is good, and you didn't realize it, but that's a polar plot, and the radius from the center to your dot represents how bad your antenna is. N2SCL, K2RIW. You got it, Gary.
Yeah, I think it's good that you're putting it into perspective, because a lot of people know some of this stuff, and but maybe they don't have it in the proper organization or map in their mind or whatever. But so this is all well and good. tune the antenna as best as you can at a specific frequency, and at the feed point, you see that your dot at that frequency is, like, you know, in the upper left or the lower right or, you know, somewhere, you know, far out near the outskirts of the chart somewhere, other than, you know, like somewhere, you know, within the 360-degree radius, but, you know, far out from the center. In other words, the gamma is approaching 1 or whatever at that frequency. How can you use the where that dot is in the Smith chart to decide what to do to make the antenna better? That's what I was getting at.
Don, good question, Gary. I'm very glad you asked it. Let's assume now that I've got two antennas side by side. One of them, somebody's done a real good job of tuning it. I connect it to a properly calibrated vector network analyzer where I told the vector network analyzer exactly how long is that cable, the transmission line to the antenna. I did all the calibration procedure at the far end of that cable. I put on the short, the open, the dummy load, and so on. And I went through the cal procedure. So the analyzer internally in its computer program knows the length of my cable. And I've got antenna 1, which is a good antenna. I connected, and I got the dot in the center of the screen, and it's 50 ohms resistive, and I'm happy, and I leave that one alone. That's my golden antenna. I picked up antenna number 2, and all of a sudden, it gave me a dot that's not in the center of the screen, and I properly interpret the screen, and it shows me the dot is on the 50-ohm resistive line, but it's up above the center of the screen, representing 20 ohms of inductive reactance. I don't know the exact number, but maybe that is approximately on the 2-to-1 standing wave ratio circle that I could draw on that chart. So I've got 20 ohms of inductive reactance and 50 ohms of resistance because the dot moved up and a little bit to the left, and it's showing, correction, a little bit to the right. It moved up a little bit to the right. It's showing me 20 ohms of inductive reactance. That's telling me exactly what the impedance of that antenna is. In that particular case, if I put a capacitor in series with the antenna connection, and I'm smart enough to choose a capacitor that has 20 ohms of capacitive reactance, it will bring my dot right down to the center. So the Smith chart is telling me exactly what the real impedance of that antenna is, and it's telling me exactly which direction to go. It's a little bit like a sightless man walking up a hill. His feet tell him which way to go, which way is up. A smart guy looking at that vector network analyzer knows which way to go. It's showing me capacitor inductive reactance in my example, and if I put a capacitor in series of the exact same number of reactance ohms, all reactance is canceled. 20 ohms of inductive reactance in series with 20...
Repeater, timeout.
20 ohms of inductive reactance in series with 20 ohms of capacitive reactance at that frequency cancels all reactance and it's gone. Only the 50 ohms is left. That's in series. Life gets a little bit more complicated if you're going to put the correcting capacitor in parallel. Mechanically, it's a lot easier to put the capacitor in parallel, and you have to do something a little bit more complicated. I'm afraid to go there right now, but believe me, to a smart guy who knows how to use that Smith chart display, it's telling him almost everything he wants to know once he is smart enough, and it's a damn good thing to learn. If you have the ability in 2009 to use a vector network analyzer, know how to interpret the screen, and know in which way to go to correct your amplifier or to correct your antenna, if you have that skill, a certain percentage of commercial world out there will beat a path to your door and will offer you money, and you'll have a job. N2SCL, K2RIW.
Yeah, I see where his mistakes and what he's having problems with, that K2KEY.
Yeah, let me go to Gary first. Gary, I think you've almost got it, and then I'm going to go over to Mel in that order. Got it, Gary. And Andy, we haven't forgotten you. Gary, you got it.
Yeah, I don't really have any problems. I was hoping that you weren't going to go there. I actually, what I wanted you to relate it to was I wanted you to relate it to the Yagi example that you guys were talking about earlier. At least that's what I thought you were talking about, because I was in the car and I couldn't really hear everything. But you guys were talking about messing with the driven element and different things, and that's what I was trying to get at. I was trying to get at, well, where were you on the Smith chart at a specific frequency, and stand up anymore. If you want to elaborate on that later, that'd be okay. N2SCL in the group.
So I'm going to try to
meet you, Y.
Joe's recognized, but you're third in the list, I'm sorry to say. You've asked a darn good question, and I'm going to relate it right now. I gave you an example of an antenna that's almost working. 50 ohms resistive, 20 ohms inductive reactance, and I gave you a hint as to where the dot would fall on the screen, you know, which way to go to make it better. That's the easy one. In the case of Joe's antenna, he had, by the measurements we now know of and the insertion loss of his cable, his antenna was nearly a short circuit. The driven element of an antenna must be at resonance at your operating frequency before it can radiate well. And if, in his example, Joe knows that he swept the antenna some number of megacycles, a significant number of megacycles, did not find resonance, his antenna was way off to hell and gone, somewhere out in the blue, in left field. When the antenna is that bad, if, for instance, he's trying to use it at 433 megs, and I'll pick a number out of the air, maybe the antenna was tuned at 420, and maybe the antenna has a bandwidth of one megacycle at 420. That means it's good from 419 to 421, and he's trying to use it at 433. When you're that far away from resonance, the antenna is nearly a perfect short circuit, open circuit, pure reactance, capacitive, pure reactance, inductive, doesn't matter. It's somewhere on the perimeter of the chart. In that particular case, you've got very little information. All you know is it's bad. And it's so bad, you can't figure out what the hell's going on until you bring it into near resonance first. So he had to do some tuning to make it fall onto the chart. He was out in the field somewhere to begin with. And in that particular case, there is a way to know which way to go, but it's a lot more difficult when the resonance is that far wrong. Good question. Glad you asked it. Mel wants to add something to all this. K2KUI, K2LIW. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, yeah, this comes up constantly, is K2KEY, understanding, misunderstanding on a Smith chart. Let me put it here very simply. What you're looking on a Smith chart, you're not going to look, you're going to look at all the points, and what I'm going to say is, if you start at the load, at the antenna, and begin to move from there towards the transmitter, that's what we're going, if you look at the Smith chart, what it says is going towards the generator, through the generator. You're going to look at everything in that line. So what is going to happen, what you're really going to look at is actually, it looks like what we call on the Smith chart, a spiral. So it's going to take in every point. And if you start at the left side, the external scale, and proceed in the direction where it says, it's an arrow, it says towards the generator, you will see, you will generally, what you're going to display, whether it's been at the end there, it's been an open or a short circuit, you will display a spiral which will take in all possible cases of what possibly has happened. Just remember, as you go from the load, the antenna, back towards the transmitter, that's going towards what we call the, going towards the, again, towards the generator. That's how they'll refer to it on the Smith chart. You'll actually generate a spiral type of graph, which takes in all cases from and way out to the middle of nowhere, right back to a SWR that goes down to 1.05. I think that, you see, that he's trying to picture it as spots on the Smith chart. It isn't. It's a continuous spiral. That's the bottom line, Dick. Over.
Yeah, this is another whole factor now that Gary and Mill maybe are bringing up, and that is, once you've made a measurement on a Smith chart, and say, for instance, the Smith chart vector network analyzer properly calibrated for your length of test cable, and you've referenced to the end of that cable, and you put your unknown load there, and you're a little bit unhappy with that load. That Smith chart, if you look at not the one that's displayed on the cathode ray tube, but you've got the paper-type Smith chart in your hand, made by Mr. Smith in 1938 at Bell Laboratories. And you can, there's a million websites where you can go where you can now get a beautiful, high-resolution, color, hard copy of that in your hand, free of charge. It's freeware. You go to the right website and you look for Smith chart, you'll get a beautiful plot of that thing coming out of your dot matrix printer. And once you look at that chart, you'll see that there's arrows on the perimeter saying toward the generator or toward the load. And you could take your particular dot, interpret those arrows as to what will happen if I go an eighth of a wave, a quarter of a wave, back from the transmitter toward the generator on that exact piece of cable, and now I put a stub tuner at that point. The Smith chart will tell you what happens if I go an eighth of a wave or four and a half wavelengths back. It'll tell you what's going to happen if you're smart enough to know how to use it. That's what Mel's getting into, and that's getting a little bit deep right now for the Smith chart. I'm a little bit afraid to go there. Just know that it's there. Know that a smart guy using that chart knows what will happen if he puts a stub tuner at some particular location. The chart's going to tell him that. And if you go to that website, amateurradio.tv, one of the lecturers gave you exactly how to put in a stub tuner to correct your antenna. You can either retune the antenna, if it ain't too bad, or you can decide to put a stub tuner in it. Maybe it's an antenna that's gold-plated, and it's got a sticker on it saying the guarantee will be void, null and void if you break the sticker, and you don't want to do that, and you still want to use the antenna, you can put a stub tuner in there, and Mel told you how to do that. Andy was one of the next guys on the list that wants to ask a question about all this. Andy, WA2CDL, the guy who runs this computer, along with our computer, there we go, repeater, along with Eric, K2LIW. You got it, Andy.
2AZ real quick.
Andy, WA2CDL, you still there? AZ, real quick, you're going to be right after Joe. Joe, I know you want to make a comment on all this. Demi2RYY, K2RIW.
KC2QAQ, can you add me on the list too, Dick?
You're there. Joe, you got it.
Yeah, the interference is not. You know, I know you talk about Smith chart to let people understand and so forth. These things are available basically on a vector network analyzer, and most people don't have access to that kind of lab equipment. Sometimes it might be better to try to explain or how to come up with a resolution of a problem using simpler equipment that people can have access to, like an MFJ, one of these analyzers that goes from, say, 200 to 450 megs, something like that, because, you know, it is nice to understand the lab theory of what you're talking about, but most people will never have access to that kind of equipment with what you're talking about.
Good point, Joe. Once you've got a RX meter, once you've got a noise bridge, once you've got a, that resistive bridge, once you've got a properly calibrated, what's the word I'm looking for now, bird wattmeter, and you calibrate your system by putting a short, an open, and a 50 ohm load on the end of the cable where the antenna is going. There's ways you can calibrate the system. There's ways without using a vector network analyzer, you can find out what is the impedance of your antenna. How many ohms resistance, how many ohms reactance, capacitive or inductive. That allows you to put a dot on that chart called Smith chart. Once you've got that dot on the chart, you've identified where your antenna is. A smart enough person will then know, I can either retune the antenna to make it a good visuar, or I can do something with the transmission line, and the Smith chart will tell me what to do. So without a vector network analyzer, if you're smart enough, by putting shorts and opens and making a measurement in the shack, assuming you've got some way of getting a rough idea of what is the phase angle, and even without a phase measurement meter, by shorts and opens and putting a variable capacitor in the right place, there's ways you can find out what you've got. That allows you to put a dot on that Smith chart, and then you know what to do after that if you've studied the problem enough. Just telling you that capability is there. I didn't say it's easy. But once you go to the word Smith chart and you Google those words on Google and you look at all the articles that have been written on the Smith chart and you study the chart itself, very valuable piece of information. This is all due to the fact that a transmission line, let me drop. If I've got a transmission line and I've got some kind of a crazy impedance at the end of it, I put a 25 ohm antenna on there. And it's a 50-ohm transmission line. I know that for every half wavelength I go down that transmission line, I'm going to see exactly 25 ohms. Every half wavelength impedance repeats on a transmission line. every quarter wavelength impedance inverts. If the real antenna is 25 ohms, and I go to quarter wavelength down the transmission line toward the transmitter, away from the antenna, I move to quarter wavelength. That 100 ohm load, or that 50 ohm load, here we go, that 25 ohm antenna will look like 100 ohms. Go another quarter wavelength, it'll be back to 25 again. In between, there'll be some reactants. The Smith chart tells you all of that. So if by one means or another, by putting known resistors, you can put a pair of 50 ohm resistors on a T connector. You know that those two 50 ohm resistors
at 8 o'clock W.
You know that those two 50 ohm resistors are in parallel with each other, therefore it's 25 ohms on the common port of that T connector. You put that on the end of your transmission line. You know you've got a 2-to-1 visor. And you make a measurement in the shack. That's a calibration point. Or correspondingly, you put a 100 ohm resistor on the end of your T connector, and only one of them. So by various techniques, you can produce known loads, make measurements in the shack, find out what happens, calibrate your system as if it was a vector network analyzer. You'll eventually come up with a dot on the chart that represents your system, your antenna. And that Smith chart will tell you a quarter wave, eighth wave, half wave away, what impedance am I going to see? Where should I put a stub tuner if that's the method I want to use to correct it? Or correspondingly, how hard does my antenna tuner have to work to correct all this jazz? So, because a transmission line does all these complicated things where it changes impedance as you walk along the line, even though you haven't changed the load and you haven't changed the transmitter and you haven't changed the frequency of operation, as you walk along that line, you will see different impedances. Those represent a circle of possible impedances on that Smith chart. So all that complicated jazz has been brought down to a chart that is understandable if you're willing to make the effort. And I think it's worth making the effort. It gives you a little bit more knowledge about how all this jazz works. Bob, AC2AZ, I think it is. Go right ahead with your question or comment. K2LIW.
Yeah, thanks, Dick. Listen, I think this is for Gary. Two things I want you to do. Go on Google and do a search for QuickSmith. It's a freeware program, Smith chart, and it gives you a beautiful, nice 6 or 8 inch diameter Smith chart. You can add inductors, capacitors, stubs, short and open, and you can watch the little dot move across the Smith chart. You can fix your load, make it non-50 ohms. You pick the load, and then you can sit there and practice adding either inductors or capacitors or the stubs to make these corrections anywhere along the length. You can change the distance between these things. So if you really want to get into Smith charts, start with that. It's automated. It's automatic. You don't have to worry about which way to go on the Smith chart when you're adding a particular inductor or something. And that'll give you a much, much better feel for the Smith chart. Two, the other thing is, if you really like the Smith chart, Times Microwave, Time Wave, makes a TZ900 antenna Smith. It's an antenna analyzer that puts out its output on a little LCD active matrix screen right in the box, and it's a Smith chart. And that'll show you your antenna and the movement of your impedances across the Smith chart versus frequency. So those are two things for you. But the Time Wave is, I think that's expensive, probably close to a grand. But the QuickSmith, that's free. It's QuickSmith, one word, Google it, it'll come up, and follow one of the sites for a free download.
SGL Quickie.
Go ahead, Gary.
Yeah, make no mistake, I work in the field. I don't need any instruction on basic transmission line theory or Smith charts. What I'm trying to get at is I'm trying to learn about antennas. I'm very weak in antenna theory and design, and that's all I was getting at. So I just want to make that clear, because everybody's giving me information that I don't necessarily need. I understand this is a learning TechNet, so that's why it's not a problem. You know, I'll grin and bear it. But that's really what I was getting at before. Over.
Very good, Gary. And now let me give you the secret piece of information that is not written in a understandable form in any of the 30 or 35 books on antennas that I own, and I haven't heard it stated by anybody but me, and I haven't seen it in any book during the 35 years I have worked in the antenna design field as a so-called professional. Here's the secret. For relatively small antennas, by small antenna I mean I'm not talking about a rhombic or a beverage. I'm not talking about the antenna that goes on for 40 wavelengths. For relatively small antennas, you will resonate first, then you have the ability to radiate efficiently. Now, there are kinds of antennas which are essentially a 50-ohm leaky resistor. Yeah, the good news is that's a broadband antenna. The bad news is it's got minus 25 dB of gain. If you're talking about antennas that have a reasonable amount of gain compared to isotropic or above, for those kind of relatively small antennas, the so-called standing wave antennas, is the technical word for them, you will resonate first, then you can radiate. In the case of Joe's antenna, which maybe it was tuned at 420 megacycles and he wanted to use it at 433, if it didn't hit resonance at his frequency, it was going to act as bad as a short circuit. Every antenna you have ever touched of a reasonably small size, something that's not a rhombic or a beverage, the energy you put into it has to bounce back and forth in that antenna 20 times before it is radiated into space. Radiation is hard. You've got to work at it. You'd like to believe the signal flows down the transmission line, hits the antenna, walks along the dipole of the antenna, and jumps into space. You want to believe that. Well, you believe that, I'm going to sell you a bridge in Brooklyn, and you'll be the 40th people buying it. That signal does not, only a small percentage, a couple of percent of that signal radiates on each pass. That signal has to bounce back and forth. Resonance means that all of those bounces are being kept in step. If the antenna is the right length, all of those bounces stay coherent, stay in phase with each other, stay in step. If they're...
Repeater, time out.
If they're out of step, if the antenna is a little bit too short, and therefore the bounces start leading in phase, you and I say the antenna is capacitive. If the antenna is a little bit too long, and they start lagging in phase, we say the antenna is inductive. Its impedance is inductive. It's a mismatch. When you hit resonance, all of those bounces stay in step. You have to resonate first, then you have the ability to radiate efficiently. That's the main basic piece of information on every reasonable size antenna you have ever seen, ever touched, or will ever use. That's an extremely valuable piece of information once you understand it. Those exact words not written in any book I have ever read. And boy, that is sad. N2SCL for any comment. K2RIW.
Yeah, that's the kind of information I was looking for, Dick. That's very good. I appreciate that. Thank you very much. I'll start with that, and I'll keep that in mind as I look for further knowledge on the subject. Go ahead.
Now, I have taken people who have got 10 and 20 years of experience in the antenna field, and I gave them that statement and say, do you agree or disagree? And you get a look like the deer in the headlights. They look at you and say, what the hell are you saying? I have never heard those words before. That's not the traditional way of teaching antennas. What in the world are you saying? And yet you go step by step. You can admit them that the antenna has more stored energy than radiated energy. The antenna has finite Q. When you put a very brief pulse into the antenna has a finite rise time. If you stop a very brief pulse being put into the antenna will ring down. It has a very finite decay time. All of those are describing every resonator you have ever used that has stored energy. It's got a finite bandwidth. It's got a finite rise time. It's got a finite fall time. It's got stored energy versus radiated energy. It's got all the characteristics of a resonator. It is a resonator. Every antenna you will ever use with reasonable efficiency, you will resonate it first at your operating frequency, that it has the ability to radiate. That all of a sudden makes it come true as to what the hell you're doing when you make the antenna longer and shorter and you put on a shunt capacitor and a series inductor and whatever. You're forcing it to be electronically resonant. Now I'm going to go one step further. The antenna is not just an antenna. It is an antenna radiating system. the system consists of the thing you call antenna, the transmission line that brings the signal up to the antenna, the impedance match that you may have put at the antenna, or the impedance match you may have put into the shack, called antenna tuner, and the final tank circuit of the transmitter. The tank circuit of the transmitter, the antenna tuner, the feed line, the impedance match at the antenna, and the antenna. That total system must electronically hit resonance if you want to radiate efficiently. You must resonate the radiating system. So now I said radiating, you must resonate the antenna. Well, if the antenna is all by itself and you're making measurements on it all by itself, that's true. In the real world, you will resonate that total system. If your feed line is low enough in loss, there's nothing stopping you from making it forced into resonance by way of the antenna tuner.
Repeater, timeout.
There's nothing wrong with forcing it into resonance by way of the antenna tuner that's in the shack, as long as the total radiating system, transmitter, final tank circuit, antenna tuner, antenna, impedance matching network, and antenna, as long as that total system hits resonance, you have the ability to radiate well. No book says that. There's a hell of a lot of people out there saying that, okay, I've got a lot of reflected energy on from my antenna, and I've got this antenna tuner that makes the transmitter happy, but what's happening to all that reflected power from the antenna? They assume the antenna tuner heats it up, it gobbles it up, and dissipates it and wastes it. No way in hell. It can't do that. If you've got a good antenna tuner, it cannot permanently, continuously absorb reflected power. If it did, it would get hot to the touch. And maybe it's a poor design made out of inexpensive components. If you've got a good antenna tuner made out of low-loss components, it will always run ice cold. It cannot absorb power. Of all the power that's reflected from your antenna, when that antenna tuner is properly tuned, it is re-reflecting that power forward, every bit of it, and is re-reflecting it forward in phase with the power coming out of the transmitter right now. Not only does it reflect it all forward, not only does it do the perfect impedance match, but it matches all the phases. You're doing that all automatically when you adjust the tuning and loading control on that antenna tuner. You say those words on the 20-meter ham band on a Saturday afternoon, you'll have a hell of a lot of people mad at you because they think you're absolutely crazy. They're positive that the antenna tuner wastes all the reflected power. Somebody has told them that. They have heard it 10 times in a row, and they believed it. And everybody's passing this old wives' tale back and forth. There's a whole lot of old wives' tales of misinformation going on in the electronic field, and that's one of them. I'm sure you guys have got some comments on this one. K2LIW listening.
2AZ.
Dick, what you're saying makes a lot of sense. So now that brings me to a question. Let's say your antenna is resonant at a particular frequency, your antenna is resonant, but it's not really resonant at the transmission line impedance at 50 ohms. Let's say it's at 30 or 40 or 70. Well, actually, I'm just going to go around the circle. But you're somewhere off of 50. You're 2-1, 3-1, whatever. Now, how would you bring in that antenna more towards the 50 ohms at that point? Because you're not going to add a series resistor or whatever, you know.
If you added a series resistor, you would make it look like a good load, but it would be lossy. A good antenna, just like a good antenna tuner, runs ice cold, dissipates no power, gives you a good impedance match to your antenna, and radiates all that power into free space. That's what a good antenna does. And if your particular antenna is resonant, but the way you couple the power into the antenna, let's say, for instance, it's a halo antenna, and you've got a coupling loop that you're feeding your transmission line into that in turn couples to the antenna. The halo has got sort of a primary and a secondary winding to it, so to speak, in RF. And you've made that loop a little bit too big or too small, or you got the wrong capacitor on the end of that loop. The loop in some cases on a 6-meter halo antenna really looks like a gamma matching rod in some cases. And so if you misadjust that gamma matching rod, you may have adjusted it for a 30-ohm impedance match or a 70-ohm impedance match. And by readjusting the rod length and capacitance, you can make it look like 50 ohms. The capacitor at the end of the halo antenna tunes the resonant frequency. The gamma matching rod at the feed point tunes the impedance that you see. It's got a minor effect on resonant frequency, but a major effect on what coupling coefficient you get from the primary to the secondary RF coil, so to speak. That halo has got the equivalent of a primary and a secondary coil with the usual way people feed it. So the capacitor at the open end, the plates, that capacitor tunes the frequency, and it's a very high Q tuning, and the gamma matching rod adjusts the impedance. So it's the combination. You have to resonate first. You could have the gamma matching rod exactly right, so it's ready for a 50 ohm impedance, but the antenna is tuned at 420. When you want to use it at 432, you won't get anything more than a milliwatt out of that antenna, even though you're pouring 100 watts into it. Resonance is that demanding. You will resonate first to give you the ability to radiate. Once it is resonant, by making minor tweaking to the method that you impedance match into the antenna, and maybe you do that with an antenna tuner, maybe you do it by adjusting the gamma match rod or whatever, you make the resonant impedance the one you want, like 50 ohms. What if that makes a little bit more sense, Gary? N2SCL, K2LIW.
Yeah, I'm pretty green with antennas, so I'm having a hard time taking some of it in. I understand all that about I understand the comment that you have to resonate to radiate efficiently. But I'm having a hard time trying to put the theory into perspective in terms of what's actually happening. I guess it's just going to take a while for my mind to accept it, because I think we're generally like inductors to a degree. We oppose a change in current. You know, we it's hard to accept a new piece of information sometimes straight away.
KEY, maybe I can simplify it.
Yeah, now we're getting into the art and science of how impedance matching takes place. Let me pick up Gary, Bob first, and then go over to you, Mill. AC2AZ, go ahead, Bob, with your question or comment.
Yeah, thanks, Dick. Boy, that was a handful. I'm ready to write you a check for that bridge. When you've got a crappy antenna, you tune that thing in, use your tuner to get you zero, one-to-one SWR on your transmitter. You've got some match on the other side, and I'm assuming your antenna tuner's matching or the impedance looking into the tuner should be a match for the antenna or the reciprocal of it. Now, wouldn't the reflected power now seeing... I'm not sure. I guess I'm a little confused. I guess that would not apply to the 50 ohm antenna line, because I assume it would still be a mismatch for that antenna line. So now it gets reflected back. When you say reflects back 20 times or so before it leaves the antenna, is that truly correct? I can see something resonating and building up voltage, but once that voltage is achieved, would it not radiate?
The only way you can make that voltage high enough is to have resonance. Very similar to what happens when your daughter is on a swing and you're starting to push her. You have to push her in resonance. Each time she gets to the bottom of the swing is when you apply a little bit of a push, and eventually she builds up a whole lot of energy and she's swinging with a very large deflection on that swing. All resonant systems do that. Your antenna is a resonant system, very similar like a person swinging on a swing. You have to push it in phase in order to build up the energy, and when the energy gets large enough, it is now capable of radiating efficiently. You may be very skeptical about the power bouncing back and forth on your dipole 20 times. That's an apparent Q of 20. Take any dipole you've ever used, particularly one that's in the middle of a Yagi. Measure the 3 dB bandwidth. Divide that into the center frequency, and you come up with a number like 20. The antenna you often use has a Q of 20. What does a Q of 20 mean? The stored energy versus the dissipated energy has a 20-to-1 ratio. There's more stored energy than dissipated energy. When you finally get your daughter swinging on that swing with a nice large deflection, there's a lot of stored energy in her body swinging back and forth. And you back away and you watch her swing down. It takes a whole lot of swings back and forth